Welcome to Communicate Like You Give a Damn, the podcast. Our guests share their stories and approaches to embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in communications because, I mean, let's be honest, we know the power of language. And language leads to behavior. So thank you. Thank you for joining us in leveling up your communications. I'm your host, Kim Clark, and DEI communications, it's kind of my thing. So let's get into it. Let's learn more about how to communicate like you give a damn. I'm so honored to have today's guest. I have admired her from afar, meaning LinkedIn, as far as the posts that she shares, her personal stories, the professional advice. The kind of work that our guest does is phenomenal. And I want to make sure that all of our listeners have some pens, some paper, and you're going to take some notes. Because especially if you're internal communications, if that's your role within an organization, you're going to want to take notes. There's a lot to learn here. And she's going to hit some of the most major questions that you're probably thinking about. There are definitely questions that I get an awful lot. So without further ado, please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you so much, Kim, for having me. I'm Katarina Rivera, also known as Katarina Rivera in Spanish, and I am a public speaker, DEIA consultant, and content creator on disability awareness, inclusion, and accessibility. And the personal side, I have traveled to many countries because I am a full-time traveler. So my business is completely online. And talking about inclusive and accessible travel is one of the things that I enjoy. That content comes out more on Instagram. So my LinkedIn content is a lot about disability in the workplace. I have started in the past 2 grassroots nonprofit programs and 2 for-profit businesses. So this is my 4th thing. I have graduate degrees in education and public health. And I also have Usher syndrome, which is the most common genetic cause of combined deafness and blindness. I've been hard of hearing since preschool, and I wear hearing aids. And my vision disability was diagnosed at 17 years old. So currently, I work with companies and organizations. I offer workshops and trainings, as well as longer-term consulting engagements to really create cultural shift, because there is so much fear and lack of understanding around disability, which is why today's conversation is so important. So we need to talk about things like ableism, how to avoid microaggressions, intersectionality, and of course, a longer-term approach is really what's going to make the difference. So I'm looking forward to sharing my stories today. And before we go further, I will give a visual description of myself. I am a light-skinned Latina woman with dark brown wavy hair. I'm wearing silver hoop earrings and a sleeveless striped shirt that has navy and white stripes. I smile often and talk with my hands. Behind me is a window and a wall with a clock and half of a thing that I think says love.
And for those who are on YouTube, if you can see what's behind me from a visual description, it's love painted over and over again on the wall in the hotel room that I am in, and I'm currently traveling. So thank you, Katarina, for meeting with me today. I am also light-skinned, very little melanin in my skin, and a black shirt, and I am wearing glasses, and I will likely be smiling a lot through this conversation as well. I'm in a hotel room scene, so there is a bed behind me as well. So thank you for that. And talk through why that visual description, if you wouldn't mind, is important.
Yeah, so what happens with the visual description is that you're providing access to information that someone who has a vision disability wouldn't always have access to. So it's kind of just providing equity so that, for example, if someone has an apparent disability, and that's something that everyone who doesn't have a vision disability would understand right away from looking at the person, that informs their perspective, that informs maybe what they're talking about, their stories. So if you have a vision disability, but you don't have access to that information, then you're not going to have the same understanding of what's being shared. And so when we do visual descriptions like this, we offer access to that information. Now, I will say within the blindness community, this is not universally loved. We are not a monolith within the disability community, and there is debate. However, my perspective is rather than not provide the information, I'd rather provide it, provide the descriptions, and if someone doesn't care about it or want it, then they don't need to pay attention to it. But if someone can benefit, then they do have it. So that's my approach.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So tell us a little bit more about your background, if you wouldn't mind. Just like, how did you get to where you are for, and why did you decide that this is your path for your career?
Well, my career path has really been a journey. I followed one thing to the next thing, and I've learned along the way. So I would never have been able to predict, the 17-year-old me would never have predicted that I'm doing this, what I'm doing now. So I really started my career after college as an educator. I was working as a classroom educator in the Bronx, and I was teaching third and fourth grade bilingual education. So that was the beginning of my career. I already knew about my disability, but I didn't have the same visual feel that I have now. I had more vision. So I worked in education for 4 years, and then I decided to try different things because I became passionate about nutrition, access to food. That was through what I was seeing in the classroom. So I kind of followed that interest, and that brought me eventually into public health and working in the nonprofit sector. And so I've done different things along the way. I worked in an after-school program, and then I worked at a food bank in New York City, and then so just community organizing and then capacity building. So I never formally worked in disability. But what happened along the way in my career is that my feelings about my disability changed. When I was 17, 18, 19, if I talked about my disability, especially my blindness, because that was new to me, I would cry. I would say, I'm going blind. I would feel that it's horrible. I had a lot of uncertainty about my future. So I went through a whole journey with my disability identity alongside my career journey. When I moved to New York after college, I stopped driving. I felt more empowered because I was making decisions that weren't limited by my disability, but kind of encompassed my disability, planning with it. Okay, how can I remain independent? Where's the best place for me? And so that meant New York City for me. And in New York City, I received services. I learned about technology. I met other blind people who were older than me and gave me role models. So all of that started to really shape my acceptance of my disability, including my blindness. In 2015, I believe that's when I got training on using a white cane. When I started using a white cane in my daily life, that was another shift for me. Being publicly disabled was hard to get used to in the beginning, because I do have some vision. I can see people staring at me. I can see people looking at me. And so many people don't understand that blindness is a spectrum. So I would feel afraid to hold my cane and take out my cell phone and text my friends and do what I have to do on my phone, do my email, because I felt the eyes of others and felt that the questions of others was like more important than my own experience and what I needed to do. So when that flipped for me and I said, wait a minute, I'm not going to pay attention to their experience more than my own. I'm just going to live my life. And if they have questions, then hopefully they're learning something by observing me. That just gave me a new level of confidence. So I became a strong self-advocate. And in 2020, I started Blindish Latina on Instagram. It was just a storytelling page. It wasn't a business idea, but I loved it. I loved the conversations I was having. I loved the people that I was meeting. And I recognized that I could do more with the platform and with my voice. And I decided to start with public speaking and offering that. I recognized that my background as an educator and a capacity builder, that I could use those strengths in the disability inclusion space and with organizations. So when I started that, it was May 2021, and I was able to leave my full-time role after the business took off. I also became certified and accessibility core competency. So that's the CPAC certification in order to gain additional training to work in this field. And so it's been so exciting to be full-time on something that I'm really passionate about, that's making a difference, and that kind of combines everything together, all the threads of my life.
Mm. Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So it's interesting, like sometimes I run into this where people will, you know, part of consultants, you know, where I consult in organizations, people will have some sort of an identity that's been marginalized, and they'll say, people automatically think I can do DEI, that I know what this is. But it's like, there's a personal lived experience that is valuable, obviously, but it's not necessarily the same as going out and being a DEI practitioner. So these certifications, even though you have a lived experience, you could stand up and say, here's my story. This is what's up. This is what's working. And this is what's not working. And yet you still pursued additional certification. And how has that helped you?
It helped me tremendously because there was a body of knowledge that I had to study to complete the exam. And it exposed me to policy around disability and accessibility, just ideas that I may not have studied on my own. So I like the accountability of having an exam to study for and a date. So that was very helpful. And now I'm part of a community with the certification as well. So I love seeing when someone has on LinkedIn the CPAC in their name. I recognize it. And I think it's just a demonstration of our commitment to the field. I also, what you were saying resonated with me because there is a big difference between someone who's going to share their lived experience, and that's super valuable, versus someone who has studied, for example, disability history, the conversations in our community, who's paid attention to what's going on right now, it's just so important to go deeper if you're going to be in the field. So that's what I have done. A lot of it has been self-taught, reading books, really staying close to the social media conversations, but then also having been trained as an educator and doing capacity building work. That is so much of what I teach at organizations. It's coming from my background as an educator, like how you help people learn and process information. And a lot of that relates to cognitive accessibility and inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, check me if I'm wrong, but when I've looked into, you know, some of the history around the disability movement, primarily based in the United States in the late 60s, there was this motto, which also became a book, "Nothing About Us Without Us." And I have felt so motivated by that phrase, by that motto. And while it can obviously transcend and apply across the board, especially for communicators, I think it's something that they really need to hear and understand, especially as they put together any kind of cultural moments or observances, that you can't run out there and talk about somebody's experience or just interview employees if you're not keeping in mind that they actually should be driving the content, and they should be saying, this is what our communication objectives are. Nothing about us without us. So we're not talking about, but the community itself that's being centered is telling their own story.
Yes. Yes. And I love that message of nothing about us without us. And it goes to so many different, it applies to so many different situations. For example, when someone is developing a product, they might think, oh, this is a great invention that's going to help disabled people. Well, if you don't talk to any disabled people, then you might come out with something like, I have this example I always share. It's a wheelchair that climbs stairs. Looks unsafe for people. It's very expensive, and the disability community doesn't want it. So they designed this whole new product. The message from the disability community was, well, we don't want to need an expensive piece of equipment to climb stairs, we want the stairs to be removed. We want ramps. So this is just an example of how quote unquote well-meaning design or just thinking of for the community comes out with things that are do not serve the community, do not represent the insights and what the community actually wants and needs. So nothing about us without us. Very important takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for that example. I appreciate that. So if there was a State of the Union on disability awareness, especially specifically in the workplace, what are the key things that we need to understand?
I communicate that workplaces are made up of people and people are in society. So we're all shaped by society's views on disability and what we're taught through the media and entertainment and through the lack of representation of complex narratives around disability. So we bring that into the workplace. And that's very important to start with, to understand that everything that's happening in society will influence interactions in the workplace. First thing that I want everyone to know about disability is that being disabled doesn't mean we have bad lives. It doesn't mean that our lives are less worthy. We are worthy. Our disabilities are a part of us. Like, you cannot separate my deafblindness from me. So it's just a part of how I view the world. It influences what I enjoy, my relationships, and it's a part of me. What I need, rather than someone saying, let's cure deafblindness, let's get rid of it, what I need is inclusion into society. The barriers that I encounter on a daily basis are often due to a lack of accessibility, not something that is inherently due to my blindness. So for example, when I go to a dark restaurant and then I can't communicate with the people at my table, I feel left out. Well, that's not because I'm deafblind. It's because the restaurant was dark and I couldn't read lips. But if the restaurant was well lit, if I was provided with extra candles on the table, and if I was provided with a low noise environment too, not loud music, let's reduce the music, all of that would then make me included in a conversation. So that's something to really think, because a lot of people focus on, oh, we need to get rid of a disability, we need to cure the disability, and that's not the message that I share. There are people, and this is important to note, who have symptoms related to their disabilities who do want research and prioritization to medical care. So I don't want to dismiss that real need, but it's not everyone in the disability community, and there is such a need for inclusion and accessibility for all of us. So in the workplace, we're not there yet. We have a lot of work to do. We all have people that are disabled in our lives, even if they aren't open about it or they don't know it. So I really hope that people do make it a priority, and awareness is a great place to start. It does help reduce microaggressions. It makes people more comfortable. So workplaces need to begin and continue their journey of making disability awareness and inclusion a priority. I always share that at least 1 in 4 adults in the United States is disabled. This is a self-report. So we're already at least 25%. So if you think about all the people who might not identify with the label or don't feel comfortable saying yes, or maybe don't know that their chronic illness, for example, is considered a disability, we have an actual number that is much higher. So there's so many reasons why this should be prioritized. When we do include disability in our planning and we make things more accessible, not only disabled people benefit, everyone benefits. And that's the power of accessibility.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You're reminding me of the whole curb cut effect, which I'll leave to you to explain. But, you know, I've also heard from people who are, you know, cane users or wheelchair users that the bumps can be problematic. And here the curb cuts were created for more accessibility, but so many more people who without a disability benefit from it, but is the curb cut benefiting mobility for people with disabilities as well?
Yes, definitely. Well, the curb cut effect, for people who haven't heard about it, is basically the fact that curb cuts were designed with the intention of wheelchair users would have an easier time to get around. So a curb cut slopes right into the street. There's no step, there's no curb. However, now that curb cuts are in many places in the US, hopefully everywhere, who do we see using the curb cuts? People pushing strollers, pulling suitcases, pulling packages, someone who might be injured and using crutches. Myself using a white cane to navigate. I love a curb cut. I'd rather do that than step down. And it helps make the streets safer for everyone. So when we talk about curb cut effect, what we're talking about is the fact that accessibility that's designed for one group impacts and helps so many other people that we're not designed for. So, and you might not even know all the ways that people are going to use that accessibility. So let's give an example of a hotel room. In a hotel room, having a bar in different places so people can grab for stability if there's a bathtub, to get into the bathtub and out of the bathtub. Someone might be thinking, oh, this is for someone who's disabled. However, anyone can trip and fall in the bathtub. It's a slippery place. Someone might feel dizzy for a moment, or someone might be tired. And when you don't sleep, your reflexes are not as quick, for example. So there are many situations in which that bar is just going to help people be safer in general. So that's kind of the lens of the curb cut effect. It applies in many different situations. But I do think that the conversations about this are much more complex. And there are, you know, there's so much more we could go into, but that's the basic idea.
Yeah. And it's something that we can adopt, that idea of designing communications, our channels, et cetera, with folks who have been previously left out of the design of the channels, and making sure once those folks inform us on how we need to set up our channels, how we need to deliver on our communications, then we know that we're going to get everybody else. It's going to be an enhanced experience for everybody else. So designing for those who have been traditionally left out of design of technological and communication channels in particular is something that us as communicators can definitely improve on. What are some other ways that we can destigmatize talking about disabilities in our communications?
So in terms of destigmatizing disabilities, talking about disability, I think, is the number one way to destigmatize it. There are people who are afraid to use the word disability. So I encourage everyone here to avoid euphemisms. When we talk about disability but don't say the word, we're communicating that an underlying assumption that disability is a bad thing or a negative thing, or an unsavory thing to talk about. So I do implore everyone here to say the word disability and recognize it's not a bad word. They're in general in the disability community. That's what we want. We want people to say the word. You might hear from people who don't like the word, and we do have to recognize that there are people at different stages of their disability journey. So I'm going to listen to the majority of the community who supports say the word. And that is also a hashtag that you can look up and see what voices have shared about that. I also think what something that can make a big difference in the workplace is if you have any senior leader who is openly disabled and who wants to share their story, that can make a big difference mm-hmm. in the workplace. It's wonderful as well when someone shares a non-apparent disability, because I think there are so many assumptions made of the people around us. And we think that if we can't see the disability, they probably don't have one. But there's so many disabled people who have non-apparent disabilities, whether that's a chronic illness, a mental health condition, a learning disability, traumatic brain injury, just so many things that we might not know. So when someone shares their story and makes something apparent that we might not have understood about them, I think that's very powerful. And it helps to create the idea that disability is just a part of diversity. It's a part of everyone's human experience, and that disability can bring expertise and strengths and a perspective that is valuable in the workplace. So I think those two things are really important. Obviously, you have to continue to do the work in the workplace. And if you can create an environment where differences are not seen as negative, where flexibility is provided and people's needs are truly heard and supported, then you will have done a great, will have made a lot of progress on this.
Yes, thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit more about language, something that we can control as communicators as well. So in your TEDx talk, you talk about switching the emphasis on people who should disclose if they have a disability, which is how HR and accommodations, that whole idea, how that whole system is set up right now, is dependent on the person to disclose. To create a more inclusive culture through everything, can you share what you mean by this when you said this in the TEDx talk? And we'll make sure to link to it so people can catch up on it and hear more from you in that talk. Share, if you wouldn't mind, please sharing what you mean by this and some examples of how the workplace can change.
Of course. I love that you're referring to my TEDx talk. I'm so proud of it. It's only 12 minutes long and it has 44,000 views. So
congratulations.
I love it. So some of the things that I shared in my talk are, first of all, in a 2019 Harvard Business Review article, they cite a study that found that 79% of disabled employees do not disclose their disabilities to HR. So we have a lot of people that are not disclosing. And what is so important, instead of focusing on increasing that percentage and then getting more disclosure, I really want employers to focus on making the workplace culture inclusive and accessible by design, focusing on disability inclusion, because that will support everyone. Remember that not everyone knows they have a disability. Not everyone is comfortable yet with their identity. If someone had asked me or forced me to disclose my deafblindness in the workplace when I was in my 20s, that would have been very hard for me because I didn't feel confident about what disability meant for me in my life. And I really just want everyone to respect that disclosure is a personal decision. And also, if someone knows what disability I have or that I am disabled, it doesn't even mean that I get what I need. People don't understand inherently, oh, I'm deafblind. You know, I'm going to a conference. I'm going to a big meeting. Like, they're not immediately thinking, oh, she's going to need captions on all the videos and she needs seating near the front in order to read lips. And we need to make sure the event is well lit and that we provide an agenda so that she knows the major topics that are going to be happening during the keynotes. And people who are holding the microphones need to hold below their face so that Katarina can read their lips and not cover their mouth with the microphone. And people shouldn't turn their back and point to things and then talk to the back of the room. You know, they are not understanding what my experience is, what my needs are. So if you focus instead of what are all the disabilities we have? Focus more on what's inclusive for what we're doing. What's inclusive for meetings? What's inclusive for communications? How can we provide flexibility so that people have access to what they need? Some people need to listen to something. Some people need to read information. How can we provide both, you know, for example? So that's what I'm advocating for. Currently, many disabled people in the workforce are overworking to accommodate themselves because they're in inaccessible or non-inclusive work environments, on top of managing a full workload. So they're adapting every day and they're not thriving. So let's give them an opportunity to thrive and get what they need, and they don't have to even disclose. So the more that you design for inclusion, disabled people won't have to adapt on their own or ask for everything that they need. That you are already really providing a lot. So there are so many things we can talk about best practices, but some of the things I share are very simple, like having an agenda, sending out meeting notes after a meeting. Let's talk about something in a large meeting that you can do. You could create a quiet space away from the large meeting. And you might be thinking, oh, this is going to be great for neurodivergent people. But other people might also use this quiet space. Maybe you have someone who has a hearing disability like me. We experience listening fatigue. We get tired when we're all day listening. Someone who has a difficult mental health day might want a quiet space to pull away from the group. So focus more on what you can create. So once you create different ways of including everyone, everyone can choose what they need and when they need it.
I love it. Very, very practical advice. Thank you. You had mentioned earlier that disability, saying that you're disabled is not a bad word. The word disability itself is not a bad word. And so let's talk a little bit more about what that inclusive and respectful language looks like and sounds like. My son is autistic, and we went through an early period, because this was brand new to myself and his other mother, that of like, what does this world look like? So we got caught up into the cure thing, but that quickly faded. And we're like, oh no, he's just gonna see the world and experience the world in a different way, and in an exciting and a new way that's unique to him. How much I would love to get into his head and see how he sees the world, especially colors and patterns. He is not very verbal, so he can't verbally communicate with us what he sees and what he experiences. But what I noticed becoming more a part of the community that supports caregivers for little kids, well, now he's a teenager. Oh my gosh, he's a teenager now. With autism in particular, we were noticing that a lot of the language and how the services were presented was very deficit oriented. What he doesn't have, how he is different. And it really pissed me off, Katarina, because it didn't just allow him to be a whole person in his own definition and in his own expression. So he's one of the many motivators I have to do this work. So I would love for you to share your experience around language and how you would emphasize for communicators to take a look and have that lens on their communication to ensure that they are inclusive and respectful.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing your experience with your son and how you thought about language in the beginning, how you shifted, and just what makes you angry. I think that is so important and will resonate with people. Some of the things with language with disability, one of the main things we talk about is how do we refer to disabled people? And so there is a conversation about identity first language, person first language, and then there's other stuff. So both identity first and person first are respectful ways of addressing people in general. So person first, the example here is person with a disability. And the word person is in front. Identity first will say disabled person, or an example with autism will say autistic. So my personal preference is identity first. A lot of people in my generation are going with identity first. In the past, and we have to understand the historical context, people have been dehumanized in our society. In the past, often just excluded from society, kept at home, not able to access school, education, sometimes institutionalized, not able to get jobs. And, so it's just so much ostracization in our society. So the advocates and the disability rights movement use person first language to emphasize that disabled people are people. They are people.
And
that's
Yes.
something that unfortunately was not happening. We were not treated as whole humans. And so that's where like person first language really emerged. And I do think that in when you're coming up with communications guidelines within an organization, you should decide what you're going to use. Are you going to use person first? Are you going to use identity first? However, when you're talking about a specific person, you need to find out their preference and honor that. And that is very important because there's such a range of preferences within the community. Even if there are trends, you have to still ask. So it's also important with language, I think, to recognize that some things that don't offend you could offend others. Mm-hmm. And we need to respect those multiple truths. So I hear sometimes within the community, there are terms that I talk about that I feel we shouldn't be using. And people will comment and say, that doesn't offend me. And I'm like, okay, but I'm still not going to recommend that we use this terminology. Mm-hmm. I do believe it's ableist or offensive. So some of these things might be like the casual use of insane or crazy to just say things, oh, the weather is crazy this week. No, we don't need to say that. That can be offensive or triggering to people who have mental health conditions. We can use other words. So my favorite one is bananas. That's bananas. I can't believe that. So I just love saying it. It makes me smile. So you can replace phrases that use disability as a shortcut to mean something with direct language that doesn't use disability. So for example, the blind leading the blind. What you mean there is ignorant people leading other ignorant people. But when you use the blind leading the blind, you are equating blindness with ignorance. And that's your perception of blindness.
Mm-hmm. And deficit based. Well,
I can't understand what my life with blindness is like. Yes, deficit based. Yes. Oh, I have different, I observe things more deeply because of my blindness. I am aware of things that you might not be aware of because of my blindness, because I have a narrow visual field. So I don't think people could understand the strengths or the just what I can gain from a disability. So that's the concept in the deaf community, deaf gain. And I love it. It talks about what do you gain from being deaf? What are the richness of experience? What's different and positive about what your deafness brings to you? So those are things that I always share. There's so many phrases to address. Falls on deaf ears, that's another one. There are euphemisms on disability. I'll give a few examples. Handy capable, differently abled. We need to eliminate those.
Amen.
And there's outdated language like handicapped. We're not recommending anymore using that. So if you say, oh, well, it's called like handicapped parking, that's what it's called. Or you can just say accessible parking, like accessible bathroom. You can just say that. So there's so much to talk about with language, but I think that when you start paying attention to it and you start recognizing what could be ableist, what could be offensive, then you can work over time to gut check language and also listen to the community and the conversations that are happening. If you're not sure about something, that is a moment with nothing about us without us. You should be talking to the experts and learning from them.
Yes, absolutely. I have the same struggle with the word special needs, and it's still in the legal, you know, profession. In order to set up a trust for my son, it's called a special needs trust. You know, and it's quite bothersome. Would you say the same when you were talking about blind leads the blind with the phrase blind spot?
I do not like the phrase blind spot. I have heard people, that's one that generated a lot of conversation when I posted about it, people feeling like that's not offensive. But to me, when you're talking about an actual blind spot in someone's vision, I don't have a problem with it. They were talking about, oh, they're a blind spot when I'm driving a truck right into my blind spot. Okay. But if you're saying, and I hear this a lot in DEI, we have to be aware of our blind spots. We have to work on, you know, addressing our blind spots. We all have them. And, you know, I'm like, well, it makes me feel like it's equating blindness with ignorance and lack of awareness and a weak spot.
Right.
And so I don't like that implication, and I don't think it's necessary. So that is something that I personally advocate against.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of inclusive language is it's forcing us to grow up and mature on the language that we use to make sure that we are using, we are saying what we actually mean without leaning on terms and depending on somebody else to have the same definition and understanding of it as ourselves. We actually need to be more intentional in our language. So I ask this question of every guest, and I really look forward to hearing what your response is to it. What does communicating like you give a damn mean to you?
Well, it does mean to me being intentional about your communication and your words, realizing that language and communication are connected to our beliefs, values, and attitudes. Language matters. For example, people, when I talked about earlier, not wanting to use the word disability and feeling that disability is bad, that is that underlying assumption that is coming forth in the language, that choices that people are making. So I think we have to recognize the true power of language and the connections to our values and attitudes and our beliefs. So communicating like you give a damn makes me really think about how powerful language is.
Thank you. Thank you. So how can people, you're very active on LinkedIn. You have other social channels. How can people get in contact with you to work with you and continue to learn from you?
Yeah. So my website is the best way to reach me for brand partnerships or work or speaking. So that's CatarinaRivera.com. I'm sure that you'll have a link to it. If you want to follow me on social, on Blindish Latina, on Instagram, I'm sharing disability awareness information and accessible travel adventures. And on LinkedIn, I'm sharing just with my name, Catarina Rivera, best tips and practices often for the workplace. And if you want to start learning more about what you can do right away with digital accessibility and things for your design and communications, I have a free ebook that shares 12 best practices for accessibility. So that's at my website, CatarinaRivera.com/free ebook.
Perfect. Perfect. Because communicators need to bring you in to learn more about, okay, here's the technology and the platforms that we have. Here's how we run our events. We want to make sure that we're inclusive as possible, that it's as accessible as possible. And we're designing this event and we're looking at our technologies in a way all the way down to just how are we doing slides in our presentations, you know, through contrast and fonts and colors and working with brand departments in that way to ensure that it not only looks pretty, but it's also accessible. So there's so much more work and so much more conversation to come from this. So make sure you contact Catarina through her website, check out that ebook, download it, take a look at it, and be very intentional around your language. And, you know, put together an inclusive language guide. It's something I work on, and I bring in experts like Catarina to review these things to ensure that they are completely on target. So Catarina, thank you so much for your time and your generosity and sharing. And we really appreciate you and the work that you do in the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much again for having me. These conversations are incredibly important.
Agreed. Okay, so what popped out to you from this conversation? I mean, it may take a minute to process, but be sure not to brush off what you just heard. Look, you just need a partner to be with you through this experience and understand what to do next. So I'm inviting you to set up a one-on-one strategy session. All you need to do is go to communicatelikeyougiveadamnthepodcast.com and you'll see the button there. The more conscious communicators in the world, the better the world. So thank you for listening, and until next time, let's communicate like we give a damn.